Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Before I begin, I want to confess something. Giving a lecture for the Thomistic Institute is always a challenge because the audience tends to vary widely. So I've had people that kind of stumble in because they see the provocative poster. It's a very nice poster. And they've never heard of Thomas Aquinas before. And then there's some people that are like getting a PhD in Thomas Aquinas studies or whatever. So you have to forgive me if some of this is either elementary or too advanced. I'm really trying not to fall between two stools on this. But there will be plenty of time in the Q&A for discussion, I hope. So having said all that, my aim today is to consider and maybe even begin to understand why someone would ever regard the soul as a biological concept, which is to say, an idea or principle, at least in the first instance, belonging to scientific inquiry concerned with living things. And only in a secondary and derivative way, belonging to moral, metaphysical, and religious inquiry. Usually debates about the soul take for granted that it's something spiritual or religious, and the debate is about whether you should affirm or deny its existence. But they agree on what they're talking about, and I'm going to call into question that assumption. But what would it mean for the soul not to be distinctively human? What I mean by that will become clear, at least I hope, but addressing this question will also invite more general reflections about natural, scientific, and empirical inquiry in general. But I think those more general themes about the theory and practice of empirical science best come into view obliquely when examining a more specific issue. And in our case, it'll be life and the soul. So a few clarifications are in order about the title of my talk, Why Would a Biologist Believe in the Soul? Why would a biologist believe in the soul? So in the spirit of my guild, which is, I confess, philosophy and not biology, I have to clarify the question itself. And I'm probably going to spend like half the talk just talking about the question. I'm just kidding. There are two similar but I think distinct titles I could have gone with. I could have asked, how could a biologist believe in the soul? And this question presupposes that, at least on the face of it, no biologist really should believe in the soul. That belief in the soul is something so outlandish and unthinkable, like how could you put pineapple on your pizza? Or how could you root for A&M? I don't know. Well done, by the way, I guess. That kind of question, how could you believe X, often puts religious scientists on the defensive. And it's helpful for religious folks to have answers. That sort of Christian apologetic about the compatibility of faith and reason, however necessary that conversation may be, is not the purpose of my talk. At the other extreme, I could have asked, why should a biologist believe in the soul? This, I must admit, is too aggressive even for me. My goal today is modest, but not, I think, defensive or apologetic, nor indeed specifically Christian or religious. I seek to describe a certain approach to life and inquiry into it and articulate reasons why a reasonable person might regard the soul as an essential part of biological inquiry. So I'm not attacking the theory and practice of contemporary empirical science outright, nor am I trying to advocate shoehorning a chapter on the soul in introductory biology textbooks, but I want to glimpse an alternative way of thinking about biology that is not merely compatible with the soul, but requires some notion of the soul. So that's my title. But here we come upon a more important part of my question. Not just why would a biologist believe in the soul, but why would a biologist believe in the soul? In other words, how might we think about the soul as a principle of biological inquiry, which is a subfield of natural and empirical science concerned with living things? Now, I'm not yet, anyway, asking why a psychologist would believe in the soul. Though that's an interesting question, And not only because it's a little bizarre, maybe even unthinkable, that so many scholars of the psyche should deny the existence of the psyche, since psyche, after all, is the Greek word for soul. Nor do I here consider why someone would or could or should believe in the soul for religious, moral, or metaphysical reasons. Again, my talk is not about whether one can be Catholic or Christian and also a biologist, or about the mere compatibility of faith and science. I think that discussion will turn out to be a lot more promising if we begin with the biological account of soul that I'm recommending today. So perhaps we can render the title a little less poster-worthy. Maybe some of you are regretting coming already since he's not talking about what I was hoping he was going to talk about. But here, a tad more precise title. We're going to first regard soul as principle of life, and then we're going to defer a discussion of the human soul. And then we're going to ask, why might a biologist, precisely as a biologist, make use of the concept of the soul? So let's pause to recognize just how strange this probably is sounding. Maybe you're thinking, even if I believe in the soul, and maybe I do, or maybe you insist that you do, it's just not the sort of thing that a biologist could or should talk about, even if he wanted to, at least not as a biologist. Or perhaps a bit different, but no less skeptical, as thought is occurring to you, we have souls. Souls are a human thing. But he's talking as if Buster the dog has a soul. Next thing, this Butachi guy is going to tell us that plants have souls. Indeed, I will. And Thomas Aquinas will join me in that. How familiar a thought is that, by the way? I'm just a show of hands, that plants have souls. Okay, a couple people. My apologies for the setup. The rest of you, try to keep up. No reason why we can't have fun here. You guys got exams coming up and everything, so, you know, let's cut loose a little bit. Part of what I want to suggest, part of the shift I want to affect, or at any rate, the alternative approach to biology that I want to bring into view, is the possibility that soul is precisely the sort of concept that a biologist would deploy and speak about. I want to suggest that the soul's natural academic home, if you like, is not theology or religious studies, but a properly natural and empirical science, biology. Since the soul is the principle not of self-conscious higher order thinking, at least not as such or exclusively, the soul is rather, can be and has been understood as a principle of life in the most generic sense. For this generic conception, I look to Aristotle, who, though a philosopher, was also, and perhaps maybe in the first instance, a biologist. So we can see that Aristotle, by the way, I hope everybody has a handout. I don't know if you need to get one. I'm going to look at the first passage here. Aristotle recommends the study of natural things. For in all natural things, there is something marvelous. We should approach the messy work of dissection and studying sinews and bones and blood vessels. We should approach that without disgust, since in every case, there is something natural and good. When you read his biological works, which few people do, it's difficult not to come away impressed. And then when you go back and read things like his ethics, you say, oh my gosh, this is a biologist writing about moral philosophy. So many of his examples are medical or biological. It's truly incredible. And it only stands out at you once, you know, once you notice it, you can't unsee it. Even Darwin, near the end of his life, was given an English translation of The Parts of Animals. And he wrote like a thank you note when he first got the book. It's like, yeah, thanks for the book. And then he read it. And he wrote a second thank you note to the translator. And he says this astounding thing. Linnaeus and Cuvier have been my two gods, but they were mere schoolboys to old Aristotle. So this is after Darwin's career, right? Near the end of his life, just weeks before he died, he wrote this note and expressed his appreciation for Aristotle. And William Ogle actually is, he's still the translation. If you look up for the free translation of The Parts of Animals, it's going to be his translation. He himself was a scientist and a practicing physician who, when he retired, decided to translate Aristotle. So it's a different time. It was Aristotle who first gave a systematic treatment of the soul as a principle of life for all sorts of living things, including trees, cuttlefish, elephants, last but certainly not least, human beings. He even complained that up until he wrote his treatise on the soul, which at least some of you have looked at, people only talked about the human soul. He seems to be following the advice of Plato, his own teacher, although carrying out that inquiry with a breadth and a depth that Plato himself never ventured. So this is your quote 3. It says, we must be careful not to ignore the question of other kinds of soul besides the human one. And if you remember, maybe you've read the Phaedo. It's a popular intro philosophy text. Socrates himself says, if you want to consider the soul more carefully, think about all animals and plants. Now, perhaps I should have asked more forthrightly then, how and why did Aristotle, in many ways the father of biology, how did he make use of the concept of soul in his biological research? How and why would others imitate him? Or what would it mean to imitate him in the 21st century? What are the advantages to starting here, whether in philosophy or in biology, rather than beginning with a concept of soul that is distinctively human, or dispensing with it entirely? These are the questions that I want to consider in the talk. A final preliminary note, this talk actually has two very different audiences, and I'm going to see what I can do to bring everybody together. The first is for those interested in contemporary science and maybe want to glimpse how other people did science, right? Aristotle was not a pseudoscientist. I mean, he dissected things. He made a number of scientific discoveries despite his errors. And you might be interested in seeing how he thought differently about some of the things. And it might even reveal our own assumptions and biases in a fruitful way. So getting outside your own tradition can help sometimes. So that's the first aim. The second aim are for those interested in the thought of Thomas Aquinas and to understand the presuppositions of his philosophy and theology. Now, although those of you that are interested in Aquinas as such might be most interested in his account of human nature, just like he was, in fact. But it's important to understand the framework within which he developed his anthropology or his study of human nature. We have the disadvantage of the distance of 750 years, and the soul has come to mean something different in that intervening period. And so if we want to understand Thomas Aquinas, we have to be careful to get past some of that obscuring and in some cases, obstructing history. Okay, what then stands in the way of talking about soul in biology? Isn't this principally a question of neuroscience replacing the need for a distinctive human mind or intellectual soul? Maybe that's a question we'll ask later. In view of that, I'd like to read a bit from James Watson's book on DNA, where he announces the supreme importance of his and Crick's and Wilkins and Franklin's discovery of the double helix and the information it's capable of encoding. This is your quote 5. The challenge presented here is not particularly subtle, but it's common and it'll be suitable for our purposes. His claim is this: with each successive scientific discovery, we remove an explanatory gap that used to be filled by God and the soul. With each successive discovery in physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, whatever it may be, we realize the revolution of materialistic thinking. The phenomenon of life is complicated, but, as he says, like any chemical reaction carried out in a science class. For Watson, life is better understood in terms of these materialistic interactions, and we come to understand those interactions and processes better every year. The discovery of DNA as a kind of key life chemical was a key moment in this process. Now, the only account of the soul that Watson considers and rejects is vitalism. And I have this on your handout underlined. Now, as with any theory, terms are used in different ways. But at least as Watson describes it here, And according to a definition that's suitable for our purposes, vitalism sees the soul as, in a way, part of the mechanism of life, although not a material part. It plays a functional role within the organic system that might be easily replaced by some more sophisticated understanding of a part that is material. Vitalism, at least according to the definition on offer, holds that, quote, the physico-chemical processes cannot explain life and its processes. So vitalism holds that some further thing, a soul, is required to explain the processes of life. And a caricature of the vitalist position is that the soul can be weighed. And at least according to some reckonings, clocks in at a whopping 21 grams, though I say that's a caricature. Perhaps a vitalist reply to Watson would be that we just haven't found the soul particle yet, but that doesn't mean it isn't there. Again, maybe this is a caricature, but it shows up as a caricature in Watson. There's a different sort of reply to Watson available, though, one which looks for the soul elsewhere. So we have the vitalist affirmation of the soul and the materialist denial of the soul. So what if it exists somewhere else? To bring this into view, it's helpful to consider a quote from Bishop Robert Barron, who's a friend of the Thomistic Institute. Now, many years ago, Bill Nye, he looks so young in that picture. I told you the talk might be getting stale. But many years ago, he kind of took this opportunity to complain about philosophy on the internet, and Bishop Barron came out with a video replying to it. And this is your quote 6. Barron says, "The physical sciences can reveal many things about the composition of ink and paper, but cannot, even in principle, tell us anything about Moby Dick. We might learn all kinds of things about muscles and neurons, but they can't tell us anything about whether a human act is morally right or wrong. A certain approach to science excludes questions regarding truth, morality, beauty, and existence, qua existence." So what is Bishop Barron up to here? Well, he argues that scientists can tell us quite a bit in their domain, but some important questions for distinctively human life, namely moral and metaphysical questions, right? They can't be covered by empirical science. In each case, he's recommending a humanistic study, maybe like your great book certificate here. The move is important, but I think it can't be the whole story. In view of this, it might be tempting to conclude that the empirical scientists are doing just fine. They just need to stay in their lane. They're not the only game in town. They don't hold a monopoly on truth, and their methods don't exhaust our grasp of reality. Now, that's all. I'm not questioning that. But I think there's something more we can learn about the practice of empirical science from somebody who has different starting assumptions. The good bishop's engagement with the science guy leaves something important unexplored, in other words, namely the vast range of fields lying between neurobiology and moral philosophy. Barron's reply was defensive, or if you like, apologetic in the original meaning of that term. One advantage of restricting talk of souls to the moral and the metaphysical and religious domains, that is, focusing on the human soul only, is that we can avoid entanglements with empirical scientists. According to this view, you might have brought with you to the talk today, the soul as such is something immaterial and spiritual, straightforwardly identified with the mind or a thinking thing. Now, René Descartes, who's no hero of Bishop Barron's, by the way, argues just this, that the soul is a thinking substance, is distinct from the extended human body, which operates according to its own mechanical principles. Soul can only be something immaterial, spiritual, independent from the body, being a principle of thinking and free agency, while the body is something material, mechanical, and in some significant sense, distinct from the soul. According to this view, non-rational animals end up being purely mechanical bodies or automata. Now, Descartes' view of the soul and body is therefore developed from metaphysical considerations, not from biological empirical ones. And I don't think you can quite see it, but his original title for the Meditations, the full title, Meditations on First Philosophy. And First Philosophy is a traditional name for metaphysics that's coined by Aristotle himself. So for Descartes, as for many of us, the soul is just not the kind of thing that could ever be relevant to empirical scientific study because it's metaphysical. So with Descartes in view, then, let's return to Watson's approach to soul and matter. Part of Descartes' 400-year-old metaphysical retreat is to grant a mechanistic conception of the body while reserving for the human soul and the human soul only some special and separate immaterial status. Note that despite arriving at opposite conclusions in the case of the human soul, these two modern views, Watson's and Descartes, well, here we go. I got behind on my clicker. We were retreating into metaphysics. So we have the materialist denial of Watson and the Cartesian retreat, but they say that the bodily mechanism is enough. They both agree on that. As Ian Hacking, a philosopher of science, has said in a rather different context, whenever we find two philosophers lining up exactly opposite on a series of a half dozen points, we know that, in fact, they agree about almost everything. So on both of these views just considered, the material body and its various parts and processes are entirely sufficient to explain all the phenomena in view, with nothing left for the soul to do or explain. We can see this most clearly in the fact that they both agree that non-rational animals are automata. Now, both of these views are going to welcome Bishop Barron's concession, because both of these views are going to say, well, sure, we're not going to, well, maybe Watson has got some chemical account of Moby Dick, I don't know. But Descartes is going to have a very metaphysical story for how humans think about the things humans think about. In other words, we can see the appeal of this Cartesian retreat, especially if you have the kinds of interests in what is distinctively human. But I think that this is a mistake. So let's consider the conception of soul that was first developed systematically by Aristotle over 2,300 years ago. What if there were somehow a soul that is distinct from these material parts, but not something magical, mystical, divine, or metaphysical? What other alternatives might there be? According to Aristotle, the soul as such is the principle of life as such. It is the animating principle of animate or living bodies. According to this, anima being the Latin word for soul. According to this account, anything that we say is alive has a soul. Trees, dogs, elephants, human beings, oak trees, etc. Things that have souls and things that have life are exactly coextensive classes. Now, a while back, the Thomistic Institute came out with these mugs that said, "No, your dog is not going to heaven." Now, that's pretty provocative, but I made the suggestion at the time that what they should do is on the other side of the mug say, "But he does have a soul," right? Because that would really invite conversation at the office. But there's a point to be made here. What would Aristotle or Aquinas mean when they say that Buster the dog has a soul? What's interesting for my purposes, to me anyway, maybe interesting to you, is that Aristotle already had all of these views on offer. There were versions of these views of soul already developed when he was writing 2,300 years ago. And he has pretty sophisticated arguments against them. So although he was aware of these views, he didn't hold any of them. He says the soul is the form, actuality, and animating principle of a living body. So what does that mean? What would it mean for the soul to have its essential operation and activity in the material parts and processes, inseparably bound up with the life activities of an organism? Dog souls animate dog bodies and their life activities. Oak souls animate oak trees and their life. It's not a generic life principle in the sense that everybody shares them like the Force in Star Wars or something. His theory requires that different animals have different kinds of soul, that they are specifically different, because their roles are to animate a different kind of life. This is quote 8. It's a little bit hard to read, but the upshot of the quote is, the soul is an immaterial but inseparable principle of a particular kind of material body. We need to unpack what the hell this could mean. Here, a key concept and illustration from 20th century philosopher named Gilbert Ryle might be helpful. He also argued against Descartes. Is anybody familiar with this example? Is the name Ryle sound familiar? Okay, good. So some people will learn something if you could. Ryle would call this sort of question, where's the soul, a category mistake. Point to where the soul resides. His own example is that of a university. Suppose after this talk, a group of you were to take me on a walk around campus, or Zach took me around campus earlier on, and he's showing me the different buildings. That's the main tower. What is it, the tower? It's got a library in there, and you know, there's the dining hall or what have you. But imagine if at the end of that tour I said, okay, but you said you were going to show me the university. Where's the university? You would rightly look puzzled and ask, what do you think we've been showing you this whole time? The mistake is to seek in the parts and processes something which is precisely not held to be one of the constituent parts or processes. It's a category mistake to ask for where's the university in the same way that you ask where's the library. Also note the distinction between the marble or bronze of a statue and the shape which makes it a statue of Pope Leo. This is on campus at Catholic, my university. Or the shape or form that makes it a statue at all. I think these examples illustrate some basic point that the form or structure of something is an important part of our consideration, though it's not a material ingredient in the same way that the bronze or each of the buildings is. But no empirical scientist is going to deny that form or structure belongs to their inquiry, especially not biologists. Any biology majors? Okay. So you guys know about form and function. You talk about it all the time, right? The formal structure of a statue or building is just as observable as the material parts and processes, after all, and it's just as available to sense experience. We get that word empirical from the Greek word for experience. So I think things become more interesting, however, when the formal principle supplies not only structural but also functional unity. So let's think about a dog here. Buster. Like a statue or building, we are able to call him a single thing that exists apart from other things in the world because he has a certain structure. But that can't be the whole story for a living, breathing, playful little schnauzer. Because that very same structure is also found in Buster's corpse, at least for a certain period of time, and if he dies in a certain peaceful way. Or Buster. His existence as a dog, that is, as a living dog. Dead dogs aren't dogs, right? I'm sorry if this is triggering. I'm only now getting over the loss of my teenage dog. Anyway, more on that later. The living dog has a certain dynamic interaction with the world, and there's a dynamic functional unity where life activities, material exchanges, certain environmental interactions, there's a feedback loop between things in the world and things going on organically in him. So a certain structure has to be there, but that's not enough. There's got to be a structure to the activity itself, to the process itself. For Aristotle, the soul is what gives this unity to living things, which is not itself reducible to the parts or processes, can be seen not only in the structure, but especially in that unified and distinctive canine life activity. His soul is the formal principle in virtue of which he is one unified thing that does the things that schnauzers do. Plays with other dogs and his favorite teenage boy. His soul gives unity to those activities, and the material parts and processes underlying them are important, but they're importantly shaped by something that makes him a whole organism. Now, you might ask, where's the soul? That question might seem tricky. On the other hand, Aristotle doesn't point to any one material part. He's going to point to the whole thing, the whole living body. And we might reach for another quote from a 20th century philosopher, Wittgenstein, who says, the best picture, in our case, of Buster's soul is his living body. Wittgenstein said it in the case of humans, but the point holds for all living things. We can point to and see Buster's soul operative in the many different yet unified life activities. Whenever we see him as a unity, we're seeing his soul, according to Aristotle. Now, I'm getting a little behind here, but there's three things, I think, where this would matter and shape Aristotle's account of living things. The first is in embryological development. He wants to say, unlike other theorists at the time, that embryological development is moving toward the mature instance of its kind. That there's a teleology to the embryo growing into the kind of thing that it is. Now, there's a lot of heavy weather made of Aristotelian teleology, and people want to say, well, we have modern science now, we don't have teleology. But what Aristotle means by teleology is actually pretty obvious. He says, look, oak trees sprout from oak trees, not from pine trees, right? You don't ask yourself, I wonder what animal we're going to have this time, right? Human beings beget human beings, dogs beget dogs, oak trees beget oak trees, and so on. And this regularity, this lack of a haphazardness or randomness in nature, is all he means by teleology. It's all he means by biological purposiveness. The material parts and processes that underlie these embryological developments are not random, but they're unified and regular. When we observe the development of organisms, then, there's a unity that's always already there. Now, it's true that DNA, in some sense, gives the formula for a specific kind of life, and so it still remains tempting to think that DNA has displaced the soul. How would Aristotle accommodate these discoveries? The chemical parts and genetic mechanisms have a home in Aristotle's system, as parts of a whole living organism that is unified by a specific sort of soul. He doesn't deny the importance of material parts and processes. He argued quite strenuously against those who minimized their importance, insisting that one must investigate the material parts. But when we study whole organisms whose unity is not random or haphazard, this is not organized, as it were, from the bottom up, but rather the whole organism is somehow prior to its parts. So we have this quote 10, what is not haphazard, but rather for the sake of something, is in fact present most of all in the works of nature and most of all in living things. This immediately continues that quote that I started with, quote 1. Or it's from the same book, it's from the same treatise. On this view, then, soul does not act as a part in the material processes, but rather gives them unity and shape so that it can both be and be understood as a unity. As an egg on its developmental journey toward being a mature chicken. The chicken's soul is that in virtue of which we can say that the unhatched chick is in the process of becoming more fully what it already is. Far from denying the material parts and processes, the Aristotelian sees these mechanisms as functional and instrumental parts of the unified life. DNA, for Aristotle, would not be the blueprint, but it would be a tool of the whole organism. You can run the same thing with consciousness. It's plausible that consciousness isn't just something that we have. When you look at Buster chasing the ball and chasing the squirrels and everything, it's plausible that he has a kind of conscious life, despite what Descartes has said. And people are coming around to this view. If you read books about the soul of the octopus, for example, it's very interesting. But what would give that unified sense experience unity? Especially if it's an animal and not a human being. This is regarded as a hard problem by a lot of philosophers and cognitive scientists. But I think the most plausible theory on offer today is one that says that the unified organism is always already conscious and has these modes of enacting their consciousness in the world. So Alvin Noe has a book about this. If you're interested, you can talk about it in the Q&A. But that's an Aristotelian answer. These modern theorists that emphasize the whole first, the whole organism, as using their brain, using their neurons to perceive, rather than the perception and the consciousness being in the neurons, that view is fundamentally Aristotelian because it presupposes the unity comes first and the material parts and processes are instruments of the whole organism. And you might run the same view with locomotion, animal self-motion. When animals move, a bunch of things happen. Nerves fire in the brain, in the peripheral nervous system. Muscles contract and relax together. And there's often a feedback mechanism between what an animal sees and what they do. Bishop Barron is quite right that empirical science can tell us amazing things about the inner workings of these mechanisms and their parts. The question is, how do we get a single unified motion, Buster running to greet me when I come home from college, how can that be explained without studying the whole dog? And at least in some sense, his conscious motion. How can the entire chain of causes and sub-processes ever constitute a single movement if Buster doesn't constitute a single unified thing? How can a motion be one if the animal itself is not unified? And our very study of the unified things needs to respect that. Watson's chemical processes view seems to rule that view out. Aristotle, in his study of locomotion and consciousness and organic development, privileged the whole organism, seeing the material parts and processes as informed by and instrumental for a form of life he called the soul. So far I've sketched how the Aristotelian will understand the soul as a formal and functional principle in biology for all living things, perhaps most interestingly for the more cognitively advanced animals like Buster. I've spoken only of aspects of animal life and not of human life specifically. You could run some of this with plants too, but they're less interesting too. All of these activities are activities of bodily parts. The soul, according to Aristotle, informs and uses those bodily parts as instruments. The soul is not separable from them. It's a biological principle with observable effects without being reduced to some special part, special mechanism. It doesn't exist outside the body as a puppeteer. In all these cases, the soul is one with the body that unifies. Now, you might have heard a similar theory. Has anybody heard of the theory called emergentism? Modern emergentism? Okay, so emergentism is a popular view. It's a common view in philosophy of mind today, where they say that life and other issues in science and philosophy of science require us to treat certain properties as emerging from lower parts and processes, but requiring its own distinct analysis. So life is not reducible to chemical reactions going on in the petri dish. It's actually an emergent property that demands its own proper methodology and its own proper toolkit for studying it. But there's actually quite a bit of disagreement about what emergentism amounts to. If what I just said sounds pretty abstract, well, there's a number of different paths one can go when discussing emergent, as they say, properties. What they all have in common is a layered understanding of the world and of the properties of natural things, and therefore a layered understanding of how we should study them. This view, at least as it's sometimes described, has clear similarities to the Aristotelian view I've presented. In neither case is life or the soul understood to be a special kind of component or ingredient. It's something that emerges from certain bodily parts. Life and its many features and activities are somehow distinct from those parts, but inseparable from them. So far, this is familiar. But a lot turns on this word somehow. So Aristotle in his own time considered a view that he called popular in the court of public discussion, but which he strenuously objected, called harmony theories of soul. According to this theory, the soul is in the body like a harmony is in a lyre, a tuning. It exists in some sense as a distinct and higher order thing emerging, as we might say, from the disposition of the material parts. Given Aristotle's own insistence that the soul exists within the body, we might find this view attractive. Yet, Aristotle gives the following reason for rejecting harmony theories of soul. The soul must be the cause and principle of the various activities and parts of the body. Harmony, as Aristotle describes it, is nothing more than the result of the disposition of the parts. Therefore, the harmony is caused by the material parts, but the soul is not caused, in his view, by the body, but the other way around. Here, Aristotle is once again indebted to Plato. Harmony is causally posterior to the lyre and its parts, while the soul is somehow causally prior to the body. So there's actually a similar question that arises in modern discussions of emergentism. All I'll say about this, as a mere representative of Aristotle, is so-called weak emergentism resembles harmony theories. If what's called in these debates downward causation from the top down is not possible, and weak emergentists say that it's not, then all we seem to have is a modern-day harmony theory. And Aristotle both considered and rejected this. So from the perspective of Aristotle, and why that biologist believed in the soul, it's clear. His view of the world is directed toward unities, regarding wholes not only as prior to their parts in our minds, but as causally prior to their parts in their worldly existence. Rather than looking out at the world and seeing disparate parts and causes that happen to come together in unities haphazardly, he sees nature as consisting of unified wholes with regularly coincident parts and activities. Among the most paradigmatic of those unified beings are living things, which regularly reproduce themselves. Okay, so now, what difference does this make? You say, oh, that's a fun historical lesson. What difference would this make? So let's go to that first target audience. People that are interested in actually learning something from Aristotle about contemporary science, or something that could be applied at least to contemporary science. What would it mean for soul to be the form of a living body today? Well, I don't think we would necessarily need another core course in medical school alongside nephrology and endocrinology and neurology. We'd have to call it something different than psychology. But that's not what I'm advocating. Belief in the soul, at least as I understand Aristotle, would shape every biological inquiry in every course so that in every instance one would be studying kidneys and neurons and genes as constituent parts of a unified organism rather than isolated mechanisms separable from other parts and processes. Nothing in the living organism is a mere chemical reaction on this view. Now, at least some of the time, you might be able to conduct your biological research in a really focused way as if it were a controlled chemical reaction. Just like you can pretend that you're dealing with an ideal gas, or that electrons fill up orbits like atomic planetary systems, or that Newtonian mechanics is correct. It's not, by the way. That's always a shocker to some people. In many contexts, though, an oversimplified or even incorrect theory might be sufficient for a given purpose. But you can't really tell in advance whether it's going to make a difference. These simplifications can only be deployed in hindsight, at least responsibly. Just as there are contexts in which Newton's approximation of gravitational effects work out just fine, like discovering Neptune, perhaps there are some biological contexts in which treating organs and cellular mechanisms as isolated activities is perfectly fine. Maybe it's okay to talk about DNA and protein, manufacture proteins and so forth, in a kind of isolated chemical way. But just like with Newtonian models of planetary motion, we might not be able to tell in advance when it's going to lead us astray. I can't get into it here, but you can Google the planet Vulcan. You didn't know there was a planet inside of Mercury's orbit, did you? There's not. But the guy who discovered Neptune's existence thought there was. Because Mercury doesn't behave as it should. Look at me, I'm telling you what I said I wasn't going to tell you. Mercury doesn't behave like a good Newtonian planet. It doesn't fit the... Newton's gravitational models are wrong when it comes to Mercury. It's too close to the sun. It was one of the first confirmations of Einsteinian mechanics, right? Is that it properly predicted the orbit of Mercury. So I'm suggesting that there might be similar anomalies that come up when you forget that you're studying whole organisms. There are certain oversimplifications that might lead us astray in biology class. But I'm speaking really abstractly, so I want to give you some examples to discuss. The first is something maybe you've heard of, and that's the growing science on inflammation and the way that inflammation operates in the organism, especially in human cases. This is a medical example, and there's plenty of examples like this. The gut biome, right, the way that the body relies upon and uses bacteria to digest things. And also, as I mentioned earlier, the study of a unified consciousness. There's also conversations about the neural basis for attention disorders and depression, anxiety, and these things, which, as it turns out, you can direct your own thinking in certain ways in order to retrain certain neural pathways. This cognitive behavioral therapy is a more Aristotelian approach to these things, treating human beings as whole human organisms that you can talk to, rather than treating it as a reductive chemical petri dish to push around and poke. But to close, consider again, if only for a moment, the magic life chemical DNA. We used to believe that evolutionary theory was principally about heritable characteristics in the genetic code, with random modification to the code. We used to believe that Watson and Crick's and Franklin's double helix gave us a clear blueprint for genetic expression. The peak of this thinking was in the, you know, way back in the 90s, where we had the full mapping of the DNA code, the human genome. But cutting-edge genetic research, some of you might even be familiar with this, I don't know, is all about gene expression. Why is it that certain genes are expressed, and why are some not? And it turns out that this requires a complete reversal in how we think about DNA. DNA is now a functional part of the organism. Rather than a ruling blueprint, it's a very special instrument in the unified life of a whole organism. And I think that coheres much better with Aristotle's idea that whole organisms and their unified lives are causally prior to the material goings-on in the parts and processes. Genetic research, in other words, is already demanding that we think very differently about descent through modification and gene expression. So this is just to say the practices, how one goes about one's research into genetics or consciousness or therapy, can be very different if you have a reductive view and if you have a whole first view, even if you don't talk about the soul, you don't use the word. I'm almost done. The human difference. So for those of you that are interested in Thomas Aquinas, audience number two, you might be interested to know that Aristotle himself acknowledges, and I've included it in your quotes, quote 8 in parentheses, quote 11, the second half, and quote 12, Aristotle himself says, well, maybe the intellectual soul, maybe the human soul is different. Maybe it's not bodily. But even for him, and even when talking about the human soul is a unifier of bodily life, even when it might have some special feature. So he holds that, Aristotle holds that the specially intellectual functions of the human soul are not the subject of empirical science, though plenty of the functions of human souls are the study of biological science. Soul is a biological principle only insofar as it is a principle of bodily life activity, but we do a lot of bodily things as human beings. And even those intellectual activities that are distinctively human, like speaking and reasoning and doing mathematics and building and flying airplanes, are done in a bodily way. So the Aristotelian account of the distinctively human soul first regards even the human soul as a unifying principle of embodied animal life and especially animal consciousness, without supplanting the biological background. Taking a biological conception of soul as fundamental, in other words, allows Aristotle to dissolve problems about how the mind and body would interact in the human case, since a unified bodily life remains part of what even the special intellectual soul explains. But Aristotle, because of this, is not able to say much about what happens when human beings die. He doesn't know what to say because he can't observe it. But he recognizes that there's something special about the human soul. Thomas Aquinas has a lot more to say about this. He's a lot more explicit that the human soul survives death. And that might not come as a surprise to you, but what might come as a surprise to you is what Aquinas says about that separated soul. He says it exists unnaturally. He says that the separated soul at bodily death doesn't exist as it ought. It can't flourish or function as it should by nature. Why? Because its job is to inform living human bodies. Human beings are living ensouled bodies. When our souls exist separately, we are dead. This turns out to actually be a key part of Aquinas' understanding of the Christian doctrine of the resurrection of the body. Without bodily resurrection, the promise of eternal life is somehow incomplete because human beings are somehow incomplete. Therefore, Thomas Aquinas, at any rate, was not at all tempted to discard the biological conception of soul in the human case. Rather, the embodied biological context of even the human soul was so essential to his theory that for Aquinas, we cannot even understand its separated existence without revelation. But that's enough of theology. What I want to suggest is that if we work hard to start from an Aristotelian paradigm of the soul, one that is foundationally biological, we can come to a closer understanding of the mind of St. Thomas Aquinas. Although, even according to Thomas's and Aristotle's view, the human soul has aspects and activities that lie outside of the scope of natural science, and therefore lie outside the scope of my talk, properly construed, the embodied manifestation of those special features presuppose a biological conception of the soul. We may be intellectual beings like angels, but unlike angels, our intellectual life is essentially embodied. So if we want to study human nature with the mind of St. Thomas, an approach with many advantages, I think, we have to remember his starting point. We should presuppose the same things he did, namely a unified and unifying principle of animal life as such. Only when we do that can we understand human beings as rational animals, and human life as a very special case of embodied human animal life. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.